Hi, I'm Justine.
And I'm Sarah Lavon.
And we are so glad you're here.
We believe that your life has the potential to make a deep, meaningful impact on the world around you. You, as a nurse, have the ability to add value to every single person and patient you touch.
We want to inspire you with resources, education, and stories to support you to live your absolute best life, both in and outside of work.
But don't expect perfection over here. We're just here to have some conversations about anything birth, work, and life, trying to add some happy to your hour as we all grow together.
By nurses, for nurses, this is Happy Hour with Bundle Birth Nurses. Welcome back to this episode of Happy Hour with Bundle Birth Nurses. It's funny we're going to have this talk because literally two episodes ago, I believe, I was like, ugh, I'm so over postpartum hemorrhage. Mm-hmm. And then yesterday, but that's what's nice about this podcast, right? Is that, yeah, we can like witness something or be a part of something. And I'm like, oh, we should talk about that on the podcast. So today we are going to talk a little bit about postpartum hemorrhage. I want to talk about something I learned yesterday because we were all still learning. And then I want to talk about some of the causes of postpartum hemorrhage and then some recommendations that the new CMQCC toolkit, the version 3, has come out with, which is a medication recommendation that we've been talking about. And then we'll just give some tips. Great. So first off, we had an in-service yesterday at my hospital and an MD came and he was educating and doing a little sim for postpartum hemorrhage. And he asked, do you know why? And he said women in this story. So I'm going to say use women. Do you know why women can hemorrhage 500 mLs? And we're like, all right. Versus if like someone in the ED, like a trauma came in and they were hemorrhaging 200, 300, they would be super concerned. In my mind, my original thought was like, yeah, like we produce more RBCs, right? Like, what don't they say? Like
we more blood volume in pregnancy.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think like red blood cells. I didn't know that actual like plasma volume increases up to 45%.
Yeah. It's total blood volume.
Yeah. Which dilutes our blood. So we make more diluted blood. So when we lose our blood, we're not losing a bunch of oxygenated blood. We're losing volume, which is a lot, but we're not losing a ton of oxygenated volume. And our body has
oxygenated
adapted.
Meaning RBCs because RBCs carry the oxygen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So whoa. I thought that was really fascinating. I was like, wow, we are so cool.
Yeah.
our bodies are amazing. So I just thought that was a fun little tidbit.
Wow. Okay.
To learn. So Sarah, 4 T's of hemorrhage.
So the 4 T's are, let me just preface by saying the 4 T's we teach in mentorship, and they are the 4 things we're looking for the causes of postpartum hemorrhage. So if you're like, oh, because obviously if someone's bleeding too much, you want to identify what's going on here and how do we stop it? And so let me see if I can go through them. They are tone, uterine tone. So we don't want uterine atony that can cause postpartum bleeding, trauma, to surrounding areas, cervical lack, even like a uterine rupture, an undiagnosed uterine rupture that delivered vaginally could be, I've had that happen, could be a trauma, tone, trauma, thrombin. Is it like thrombin? So like a clotting disorder.
Yep.
Right. That like you don't have the necessary components to clot.
Yes.
And I truly don't have my notes in front of me, which I am very impressed with myself right now. Although I'm not going to be able to get the last one. Tone,
yes, you are.
Trauma, thrombin. Give me a clue.
When something's, you have to get something out.
Oh, a retained particle of conception.
So what would that be?
A tissue. Holy moly. I'm like,
you're like, I know the reason.
I know the reason. So tissue, meaning there is retained tissue inside. I feel like just retained anything that's preventing the uterus from clamping down, causing more bleeding and, or, like an invasive placenta. So like an accreta, percreta undiagnosed in that case, because hopefully it's been diagnosed ahead of time.
Right. So he also mentioned yesterday that sometimes, you know, you inspect the placenta and they're like, yeah, it looks great. And then they get rid of the placenta and then she does have, or they have a retained placenta and why does that happen? And he taught about how we can have that extra lobe. And so you'll have a placenta and then you'll have membrane. And then on the other side of that membrane, you'll have another lobe. And so we're not expecting that extra lobe.
How often does that happen?
It's a good question, but it's just something to think about. So if you have atony is like not your issue and you're like, the fundus is firm, but they're still bleeding, but that placenta looked okay. Maybe, you know, some of that conversation with the doctor is like, is there any way she had like an extra lobe? So maybe just remind them too, like, oh yeah, that's like possible technically. So just a little something there.
And the only way to know that would likely be by a bimanual.
Yes.
Or ultrasound.
Yeah. I was going to say, so they said that, especially if you're in the middle of a hemorrhage and you've given all the meds, it's going to be really hard to like get in there. And so the best thing would be an ultrasound, even though it is pretty hard to see that in an ultrasound.
I've seen them usually come in with an ultrasound a lot in hemorrhages.
Yeah. And so I was actually prompted to keep that in my mind as like the charge nurse on the unit to be like, oh, I'm going to make sure I get ultrasound into the room when we're having a hemorrhage for my nurses and the provider, just to have as an option. So I never thought about that before.
Yep.
We're always learning.
Yep.
So
rule out your four T's.
Yeah.
Tone, tissue, thrombin, trauma.
And so another interesting fact was he was describing, and I would love if an OB or a midwife could chime in on this, DM me about this, but how after a patient has been laboring for a long time and pushing for a long time, his words were the vagina wall and the vagina canal is like butter and is so susceptible to tears. And that's why sometimes you'll see when they're pressing, like you see to
barely touch.
Yeah. And they start bleeding. And so, you know, and maybe if you've been pushing with a patient, you've seen that too. And so that's why if you're using forceps, which I know are more rare these days, it could cause trauma. So if you have a forceps delivery, you should be thinking trauma is on your mind.
For sure.
So that was a little.
Also one of the risk factors for postpartum hemorrhage.
Yeah. Is
what's one of the highest risk factors for postpartum hemorrhage?
A previous hemorrhage?
Is a risk factor. That wasn't the one I was going for.
What is the highest one?
Would it one be of. Like
a cesarean? Now I'm looking at my notes because I want to cheat. I would think like in my mind, I'm like big baby, long induction. Like
you're onto it. Yes. It is long use of Pitocin.
Yeah. Okay.
The like prolonged use of Pitocin. So which is why like we need to be paying attention to also like if they're there for an induction, go up. It's not the dose of Pitocin. It's the length of use of Pitocin.
Yeah, those uteruses
get them to adequate. Yep. Get them to adequate. And then if it's not working, give them a rest.
Yep.
You know, and that's not your decision to make, but it's something to have on your radar for your 3-day induction. And we all like, if you've been in practice for a while, you kind of naturally like, oh, they're a long induction. I like need to be ready for a postpartum hemorrhage because the uterus is tired, but it really is truly related to prolonged use of Pitocin.
Yeah, I'm looking at the notes now because I'm cheating. But they classify prolonged use of Pitocin to be over 24 hours. And that's common, friends.
Yeah.
So
unless you listen to our induction, our speedy induction podcast.
Oh, yes. Listen to that.
I haven't had one of those in a long time.
Yeah. So you have your reason. So tone. So we're always, you know, massaging that fundus, seeing if it's firm. If you have a firm fundus and they're still bleeding, move on to the next. So do they have risk factors for trauma? Did they have an operative birth? Was their cervix completely dilated when they pushed that baby out? Did they have a precipitous birth? And is there a hematoma? Things like that. If you're ruling out that, and obviously it's not just you ruling this out, do they have retained placenta pieces? Sometimes with the retain and the clots, I'm thinking the fundus is moving up. You can get it to be firm, the blood will release, and then all of a sudden, like it starts moving up again and they're still bleeding.
By moving up, we're talking at the umbilicus.
Yes.
So it's higher above the umbilicus. Umbilicus, which one do you say?
Umbilicus.
My nursing prof would say umbilicus, and it always like I like chuckled. I still do.
Yeah.
So like you've assessed, I'm 2 finger breadths below the umbilicus, the belly button. And now it's one above like that. You absolutely should be paying attention to.
Yeah, for sure. And then, or like there's a steady trickle and it's just not stopping. could be a sign that there's retained placenta. So you can, you know, you make that phone call, you get the doctor in the room to just assess if that's something you're worried about, or the resident. And then next could be a thrombin issue. So really looking at their labs, you know, was there something you missed? Do they have low fibrinogen? Like, what could be there to indicate that that's a thrombin issue? But the most, for the most part, the highest percentage of our postpartum hemorrhages are uterine atony. And so medication-wise, meds we're going to give right away. I will say that at my facility, we throw Cytotec at them right away, but that is not the recommended course. Mm-hmm. So on the topic of meds, CMQCC lays this out really nice for us in all the different stages. And so if you don't quantify the blood loss in stages, this might be a new topic for you. You have stage one, where you should activate your hemorrhage protocol that you have in place at your hospital. So for this one, stage one's a little iffy because newer research was going to, like, it needs to be 1,000 standard, but we know that more than 500 in a vaginal birth is abnormal. And so you'll see either 1,000 total or 500 in a vaginal, 1,000 in cesarean, or if they say 1,000 total, they'll have a disclaimer, but 500 is abnormal and you should be, like, really assessing that. So we'll just say for this podcast, over 500 in vaginal or over 1,000 in cesarean with continued bleeding, or there's signs of, like, abnormal vital signs, we would activate stage one hemorrhage protocol. Mm-hmm. So for this one, for meds, you are going to make sure that you're giving your Pitocin, that is activated. You're doing that.
Up to 40 units though. We really need to be paying attention. I reviewed a case in mentorship actually, where, like, somebody, she got the 20 and then the provider was like, give 10 IM. And then two nurses gave it in the thigh or something. And then they ended up at 60 and it was like this whole drama. So, and in emergencies, we know that when we're giving medications, that closed loop of communication is so important, especially if you're, like, giving things with a verbal MD order and then putting them in later. It's like, who's doing each thing? That same thing goes for TURB. I've seen TURB given more than once too, of like, I just gave it. Wait, you did? Like, you know, that's besides the point, but we're definitely not giving TURB here, but to pay attention to who's doing what.
Yeah, that's great.
You know you need CEs, but what if you could get them while at the same time setting aside intentional time for fun, relaxation, and personal growth to keep you going and able to give your best to your patients? We have the answer we've dreamt of. You don't want to miss out on this life-changing experience we are creating just for you, L&D nurses. Join us in the tropical and stunning Secrets Akumal right outside of Cancun, Mexico on May 18th to 23rd, 2023. Registration is now open. Learn with 400 other L&D nurses from all over North America about physiologic coping, logic birth, and coping with labor work together, trauma-informed care, actual therapeutic communication, and yes, we'll throw in some positions practice just because we can. Join us for only 3 hours of experiential learning a day. The rest is yours to enjoy the all-inclusive resort, activities, optional breakouts, or even snorkel with the sea turtles right in front of the resort. This will be an experience you will regret missing. We want to spoil you. You work so hard and deserve a life-affirming break. Register at bundlebirth.com/move-learning-retreat. Roommate matching and payment plans are available today.
And then it'll say in stage one to move on to those second level uterotonics. And what they consider second level uterotonics are going to be Methergen, Hemabate, and then Cytotec, only if the patient is hypertensive or asthmatic.
Mm-hmm. So we're moving away from Cytotec. Yes, the shift is away from Cytotec.
Yeah. Rectal. And so in all of these two, they want you to have TXA on your mind to consider TXA. The thing about TXA is that it's not for uterine atony. It doesn't work that way. It's for clotting. And so if you can fix the uterine atony, you don't necessarily need the TXA. But I did hear yesterday that our rates of maternal mortality with hemorrhaging has significantly decreased with the introduction of TXA in the OB world. Mm-hmm. So TXA is great. And so if your patient does not have hypertension, you want to do Methergen, 0.2 milligrams IM. Or if they do have hypertension, you want to do Hemabate, 250 micrograms IM. What's nice about Hemabate and why a lot of physicians like Hemabate is that you can give it, like, every 15 minutes for, like, 8 doses, which is like, if it's not working, give it again. If it's not
working, some Imodium, please.
Yes. And I was going to say, but it does give those side effects. So you want to, as a nurse, call out for Imodium because it will cause awful diarrhea for your patients. Mm-hmm. If you are giving Cytotec, they want to do Cytotec sublingual. It doesn't have to go through the GI tract. If you do rectally, you're going through the GI tract. So you have to go, or PO, and it doesn't have to get filtered through our organ systems. If you're doing it sublingual, it's going straight to the blood system. So put it under their tongue and it's going to dissolve. I know that's something that we don't do on my unit, and we're going to try to push to do sublingual more for our hemorrhages.
I think that, like, with the meds too, it's sort of good to understand the workflow that PIT is our first line of treatment up to 40 units, consider TXA early, and then go through, do they have risk factors for any of the postpartum hemorrhage meds, hypertension or asthma, decide accordingly, go for one of those two meds. If they have both, then we go to Cytotec sublingual.
Yep. So besides these meds, our nursing interventions, so as we know, are to, one, facilitate all of, you're going to call your team in. You're going to make sure that.
Get some extra hands.
Yeah. You're going to have some extra hands. You want your provider to know what's happening. You want your charge nurse. You want your anesthesia team. If you have midwives, you have your midwife, you can have your midwife in hand, but with the provider coming, the OB, and then you're massaging a fundus. You're making sure the vital signs are tracking, making sure their bladder is empty. For any of these interventions in the future, you want to make sure their bladder is empty. That could be with a straight cloth or a Foley.
I say leave it in if they give you permission, so you know that's never becoming an issue.
Yeah. Make sure your scrub tech, if you have them on the unit, is there. You might need some supplies in the room. So if you know, like, you can anticipate a DNC, there are some speculums you might need. You might need the
ring.
The ring forceps. Every time they ask me, I'm like, ooh, I don't know where those are. And I'm like, I need to learn where those are so I can get them.
Slash call someone for them.
Right. You might need some sutures. There's just activating. And then, like, what's the family doing in the room? Where's the baby at? How informed is the patient? Are you updating them on what's happening? You know, being honest and open with communication, letting them know we're here for them is really good. I would say if you're a unit that type in crosses, and so were you, Sarah, did your units type in cross?
I thought not type in cross.
Oh no. Did you type in screen?
Everybody. Yes.
Apparently not everyone does that.
Oh, wow.
I didn't know that. And so if you are a unit that type in screens, this might be the time to be like, hey, you want me to type in cross and hold two units? If you're not a unit,
this is the time to do it.
This is the time to type in screen.
Type in screen, but throw it in as a cross. It is no harm having a cross match on hand when you already know their bleeding is more than normal. So that's also second line. When you throw in the second line, a lot of times for a type in screen, they need a double verification of the blood.
Yeah.
So draw some labs while you're at it to get, and not that they're necessarily accurate, especially like an H&H or whatever, but you get some labs, some more information, and then they can type in cross at that point when you're getting your second line in.
Yeah. And I'm actually looking for the blood bank part of the CMQCC algorithm. They want you to type in screen everyone that's medium risk on your hemorrhage risk assessment. Mm-hmm. And so instead of doing everyone. So we do everyone, and I'm really glad we do everybody, because like you said, it takes a while for them to do the second verification.
I think too, for nursing interventions, one of our best indicators of decompensation is our vital signs. Mm-hmm. And so often, like, you know, they're cycling every 15, bump it up to every 5, throw a pulse ox on them. So you have that regular data and you can watch the trends of what's actually happening, because a patient who's not tachycardic with a normal BP at 500, I'm less worried about than somebody who has a steady trickle, but is mildly tachycardic and their blood pressure has dropped by 5%, 10%. 5 is probably expected. You know what I mean? Like those vital signs, especially in the PACU guys, like this was something that as a preceptor, I nailed in because I'd had so many subtle cases that were caught based on a slight tachycardia after surgery. And like that tachy, especially they're on the EKG. So that's like really helpful, but a continuous pulse ox is the same thing. And like, wait, they were 80 and now they're 101. Noted, you know, might be something to throw in the chart and notify your MD about, hey, blah, 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 I'm seeing XYZ. Cause that slight tachycardia is one of those very early signs that if you catch it, you can stay ahead of the game, especially I'm thinking like post-op complications and hemorrhage.
We normalize abnormal vital signs all the time.
That is so true. That is so true. I'm like, oh, well, it's a little elevated blood pressure.
Well,
like
she's 110.
Yeah. She's nervous.
Yeah. No, totally. Or the low blood pressure for epidural.
Mm-hmm.
Like.
What's the first sign for low blood pressure in your head? When they like say post epidural, the patient's gonna run low. What's the first thing you see clinically?
I think I start seeing D cells, or I see like they're nauseous.
Yes. It's nausea. That was something like, especially if you're a newer nurse, like you just got an epidural, you lay them down. They're like, ooh, I feel kind of nauseous. The nausea will likely hit before lightheadedness.
Mm-hmm.
So throw a blood pressure, like start your blood pressure and open them up and just know it's coming. So once you hit stage two, which remember is 1,000 to 1,500 mLs QBL, you're needing a lot of things. You better have that second IV in, you're prepping the OR, you're maybe giving oxygen by face mask, activating a rapid response at this point. And this piece, I remember when we were filming mentorship and putting this curriculum together, being like, really? You know, it feels premature because we're so used to like, we'll handle it, or, oh, it'll fix itself, or, oh, it's fine. But this is that response to the morbidity mortality crisis in the United States. We have to be a smidgen more, by a smidgen, I mean that sort of sarcastically, like more on top of it. And I think we need to start taking this much more seriously. And what I love about these documents like CMQCC, like AWON standards, is it gives us backing for, no, based on the QBL, the OR needs to be opened. That second line needs to be in. We need to be giving meds, and we're activating a rapid response.
So we've been activating rapids more so at my facility. Ooh. And
I don't know what it is about a rapid that I'm like, no, we don't need them.
I know. And obviously we need them because the mortality rate in this nation is awful, right?
So, and more hands, more supplies, more awareness, more help, especially at this point, they're postpartum. They're not pregnant anymore. It's a postpartum hemorrhage.
And
they're
we can
surge patient.
And I heard something yesterday too. My director was talking about this, like get the team there and then release people you don't need. Like you might not need this person, but you need this person. So you don't have to have everyone there that comes for a rapid, but maybe you just need that one nurse or whatever. Yeah. But we've been activating them to do when we do our massive transfusion protocols. And we'll talk about that a little bit later. And they will run the level one rapid infuser. Mm-hmm. And that's been they really nice.
Mm-hmm. Rather than anesthesia.
Yep.
Interesting.
So that's been really nice for us.
Well, and moral of the story is you have to have these conversations. Like these are the conversations you're having at the nurse's station when you have a moment, which we all have a moment, or even on your break, you're at the, like you're in the nurse's lounge and like, what do they do for that? Or who normally comes? At what point do we usually activate rapid response? Mm-hmm. When you have your manager there, what point do you want us to? Because CMQCC says, and that by the way is a California collaborative, but it is nationally recognized. So it comes out of California, but it also applies to your state, regardless where you're at. But at 1,000, they're saying give RBCs. Like 1,000, the number of hemorrhages I've been a part of were like, oops, we should have transfused, you know, and like they feel better, you know, and you're ahead of it versus once you start getting behind, there comes a point where with a hemorrhage where you cannot catch up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where our mortality comes in and why hemorrhage really does need to be taken seriously.
Yeah. And you brought something up too. It's mortality, but it's also morbidity. And so maybe that early transfusion helps perfuse their organs that later. Now we have patients that are on dialysis the rest of their life because of their postpartum hemorrhage, right? And they didn't have enough blood infusion.
Yeah. We're so afraid of like, oh, they don't need blood. And like, what's the resistance? That's what I want to ask. Maybe we ask our anesthesiologist this of like, because I feel like it's sort of anesthesia of like, no, I'll give plasma. No, I'll give blah, blah, blah. That's like, there's some pushback to transfusing. And I know transfusion reaction, whatever, but if you've type in crossed and I guess a blood shortage, like we're trying to be careful with not overdoing it. But if we've seen the blood out, then give them some blood back in. Blood is life. Anyway.
Blood is life. I wanted to mention, I wanted to pop in here to talk to you a little bit about the vital signs because we talked about that a second ago. There is clinical signs of hypovolemia. So at 1,000 mLs, there's a slight change in vital signs, but it's not till 1,500 mLs that you'll see more vital signs. That's a lot of blood.
That's a lot of blood.
Right. So
and our estimations are terrible at this. And we have to always also consider if they have vital sign changes, where is this blood going?
Yep.
Internally into a hematoma, you know, that like, just cause they're, you don't necessarily see it into their uterus, that their uterus is full. You express 1,000 mL of clots, you know, covering the bed.
Totally.
Like that's a lot.
And their number one sign is narrowed pulse pressure. So they mentioned that with a hemorrhage, the diastolic pressure will rise because it reflects vasoconstriction and then it narrows the pulse pressure. So you have less of a difference between your systolic and diastolic. You're
interesting.
It is significantly narrowing. Tachycardia, and then their diaphoretic, sweating, weak. And then you have greater than 2,500 mLs, you are going to have, And then you get up to 2,000, you're going to have hypotension, the narrow pulse pressure, tachycardia, which is they quantify as over 110. And then tachypnea, they define that as over 24 for our postpartum people.
Interesting.
And then they're going to be pale. They might be cool to the touch. They might start getting restless with some mental status changes. And then we're looking at their urine output. That is important. So if you have a Folium, that's nice.
So let's just say we have a patient. We're in the PACU. They had a scheduled C-section. Maybe it's not scheduled. No, they had an unplanned. They labored and had a C-section. And you're monitoring everything. You're concerned about fundus rising. You're not seeing a ton of blood loss out the vagina when you do your fundal pressures. They feel mostly firm, but you're starting to see some vital sign changes. What do we do?
I would call my provider.
Provider says, it's fine. She seems stressed out.
I would look at my other things. So what's my urine output? How do they feel? What's their, how are they acting? Are they acting the same? It's nice when I've been in labor section and recovery with them, because then I've known them this whole time. Mm-hmm. But if I don't, I can ask the family member, like, do they seem like they're acting themselves?
He feels a little out of it because of like C-section meds is what the anesthesiologist says. Like she's like there, but just like extra kind of lethargic seeming.
What's her urine output?
Like 20.
In how long?
45 minutes.
And I feel uncomfy. Like I have like a pit in my stomach.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what's the, like, and I can tell by vital signs. So I don't see blood. The fundus is high.
Fundus is not high, high. It's like one above.
Uh-huh.
And you're massaging. It feels firm. Nothing's coming out. It's just like normal firm. No, we'll say firm. It feels firm, not like a softball in the pelvis, but you know, you're like, it's kind of on the larger side, but I don't know. Maybe she just had big anatomy, like a big uterus. So that justify it. And then the blood pressure is used to be 112 over 72. And now it's 100 over 61. And the pulse is 101. Previous pulse, 75.
Her belly is soft all around her fundus?
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like normally in real life, I'd be like, I feel fine. But because we're having this conversation, I feel like I'm on the spot. Yeah. I would use my cuss words and I would say, I'm concerned. I need you to come to the bedside.
Okay. And the provider is like, I don't really want to.
Okay. Then I'll escalate to my charge. And have her come to the bedside.
Charge comes, anesthesia comes, says they'll give plasma. And by this time, they're 110. And the patient is diaphoretic.
Okay.
Resident comes, evaluates. Charge is there. Everybody's kind of like, I don't know. And she's cognizant. She's level of consciousness normal. She's like supporting her baby, but like looks kind of pale and tacky. Blood pressure is... now we'll say 100 over 78.
So the pulse pressure is narrowing, is what you're telling me.
Yeah, we just turned this into a case study.
Yeah, we did. So then I have my charge, anesthesiologist, resident. Is the resident talking to the attending? And is the attending still not caring?
Yeah.
So at this point, I'm going to get my hospitalist involved. So I call them and ask them to come to the bedside and tell my concerns. And what happens?
They say, give her 2 units. So they gave her 2 units.
Okay.
And she improves. and say, keep watching in the PACU.
What's her urine output now and how long has it been?
Same. No more urine output.
Okay. So I would escalate this further and say, I don't agree with the plan because her urine output isn't changing. Something's wrong.
Yeah. But sometimes post-op, like there, everything slows and, you know, we just give her 500 mLs more of fluid and just give her body a second. Just keep her in the PACU for continuing monitoring. So, and by the way, her pulse is now 97 after the PRBCs, 2 units and plasma, if I remember right. And now it's 98 and you're like, oh, okay, I'm appeased for now. So you keep monitoring her in the PACU. Okay. An hour later, her pulse is back up to 106.
Her urine output's the same and I already gave the bolus?
Yeah. Maybe you have a little bit of urine, a little bit of urine. It's dark, but like there's urine. It's so interesting that you're fixated on the urine output. I don't know that that would be my instinct.
It's been my new thing.
Because just everything slows when you're...
Because I'm thinking internal bleeding. And so...
But why would that slow urine output?
Because I'm thinking if she's bleeding, she's not perfusing her organs. And like, is she right. not perfusing to her kidneys and okay, giving fair. Urine output?
Okay.
So...
So you think she's internally bleeding?
Yeah, if she's not bleeding outwards. But okay. You're making me worried. You're just going to tell me at the end here, like, she's fine.
It was nothing.
So, okay.
So now she's back up to tachy. Fundus firm at the same level. She's now starting to feel a little bit dizzy. Doesn't feel good. Maybe a little like just icky feeling. What do you do?
What does the rest of her belly feel like?
Fine. Normal. But like post-pregnant. Okay. So at this point, you, in theory, yes. Yes. There's a second line for the blood already. And you sent labs okay. with that. But your labs are like normal C-section. This is like an hour and a half after C-section. Like how accurate yeah. are they? You know, yeah. something. It's lowered, but nothing critical.
Okay. I don't know. Because in my mind, she's got blood, right? She's her mm-hmm. fundus is firm. Mm-hmm. Her, I'm normalizing her vital signs in my head.
Yep.
What's her respiratory rate?
18.
I mean, all she has is 106, which technically tachycardia isn't over 110 mm-hmm. for this. So I'm going to wait.
So what I want to note here is that you gave 2 units of RBCs and she improved.
Mm-hmm.
And now she's not the same. She's now less better. That's like not clinical.
So how but long,
see what I mean?
It's real though. So how long this is real after life. The 2 units did?
An hour and 15.
So an hour and 15 after the 2 units, she's mm-hmm. getting worse again.
Yeah. You see the pulse start creeping.
Okay. So I guess I would mention that.
Okay. Provider says, cool. Keep watching. It's not tachycardic. Your gut says, I don't feel good about it.
So she's not tachycardic.
106. What did I say? 106? Yeah, 106. 108. Now it's 108.
But, and so how's
just her, got off the phone.
How's her mood?
She's real mellow, kind of lethargic, looking kind of pale. Something's off. Dry mouth.
I'm going to relay all those and then anything else from that?
Diaphoretic.
I mean, I
anesthesia like now. Yeah. So you call anesthesia. You're like, anesthesia, somebody's got to be in here and look at this patient. I am done with this. Anesthesia looks at them and says something's off. We got to escalate. Anesthesia finally calls your doctor.
Finally.
Yes. I'm going to give you the end of this story. I exaggerated a few things, but I had 2 cases that I will never forget. One of which, I was the primary and I was in the PACU and it was mostly this case. They gave like plasma instead of RBCs. Like it just felt like the clinical course was weird. And I kept being like, something's off, like she's not right, whatever. They ended up taking her back and they found a retroperitoneal bleed. And opened her up and had like 2,500 mLs in her abdomen. It was quite the case. So I'd had this case, and then I was orienting a new nurse, and we had the exact same clinical presentation. And this time I was much more diligent about being like, no, you need to assess her. No, something's off. No, I'm seeing this creep. And I pulled up like the graph of the vital signs, and it was the pulse actually that got them paying attention to me, other than like now. And I was like, her pulse is beginning to rise. They gave blood, saw an improvement, pulse went back down. And then after a little bit of continued monitoring, pulse began to creep up. And I'm like, there is a trend here. She recovered from the blood. Something is not right. And they ended up opening her back up. And it was like, they found like 800 in the abdomen, and they went back like hours before this time. And I remember talking to my orientee and her being like, oh no, like the pulse, and me being like, it's 106, but something is off, because her baseline was like 70s.
Mm.
You know, this is not normal for her. And so this is where like I learned from the first case, where like both of which survived, who knows what the morbidity turned out to be, you know, knock on wood, but like our astute nursing care, why are we one-on-one in the PACU? Because they're post-op, you know, and they're, and like, if you look up, just Google retroperitoneal bleed, so you can see where this is located. It's like an internal bleed, right? Mm-hmm. And what happened was, and I've heard of cases where you open them back up and what's tamponading the wound is the actual blood. And the moment you open them up, they code. So this is where like this issue, we need a trigger warning on this episode for sure, because this is, we have to be taking this seriously. And us as nurses, if you are not getting the response that you need from your providers, you got to push it up and you have to document this. I am pushing it up. Charge nurse, something is off. And this isn't being hyper. You want to give tangible evidence that something is off. Pull up the trends. And I remember seeing the graph of the pulse and it being, and then being like, oh yeah, we gave the blood, it recovered, and now it's creeping back up. I'm like, there's something going on here, and it's your job to figure it out. I'm telling you, there's something going on here. I am seeing with my eyes. And luckily that orientee actually got oriented to what it means to be on top of your nursing care. You know, and that first round, luckily there wasn't a poor outcome, but I learned very quickly, like, oh, what is this retroperitoneal bleed thing? And post-op, this is why our C-sections are actual like risks, you know, it's like the risk of mortality in a C-section is like 4 times as much as a vaginal birth. So anyway, that's my little tangent, random case study. I didn't mean to put you on the spot, but that's real life, right? And they're like, oh, it's fine. Oh, it's fine. Oh, we gave blood. Bye. Like, no. You know, and like, I'm like, I don't know, something's off, or like, well, they're sweaty and their pulse is 100. What was it before? You have to be watching the trends. And the moment it starts to get up and like, you're watching the response times, push it up your chain and make that response happen. We can't be leaving these patients. Well, it has to go beyond, I notified the doctor and I wrote it down.
Yeah.
It's not about documentation. There
no
are
new orders received.
Lives, right. There are real lives on the line here. So I feel like I've been coming in hard and I act like I know what I'm doing, but like, this is hard stuff, you know, and these are this is why we're actual nurses and why they have a registered nurse involved in their care, because our job is to assess and notify of changes in status.
I think that's a good reminder, because you're absolutely right. And then notify changes, give recommendations. But overall, one of the reasons I was like, hemorrhages are lame in the last podcast was, I don't know, because I guess I'm sick of them, but they are happening. And what's nice about hemorrhages is we do have a lot of steps that we can take. And we have these, we keep talking about them and keep reading through this material. You will know the steps to take. There's not that many meds, right? There's a handful of meds, a handful of interventions, and a handful of things we can do alone. And then we need to call the team.
Yeah.
So we're going to link the CMQCC toolkit on this episode so you can look through it.
And use it as like backing for you. If there's pushback on interventions, it's like, at this point, we need to have a second line in, guys. Like, where, what's our hemorrhage protocol? Where, mm-hmm. who's the extra in the room? What's anesthesia doing? You know, like what meds are being given? What meds do I need to grab or have mm-hmm. someone grab for me? You know, it's like, it's being on top of our nursing care. This is leveling up our nursing care and not being lazy nurses, mm-hmm. which none of us want to be, especially when we end up having to deal with the consequence of what happens when we're not paying attention.
Yep. And if you're at a hospital that doesn't have those kind of resources, you don't have protocols, you don't have massive transfusion procedures, you don't have a hemorrhage cart, then this handout will help you do that. Just like she said, use this mm-hmm. as a guide, use this as a tool. It's 279 pages.
Mm-hmm. And I will say that this episode is going to come out before Black Friday, but stay tuned for Black Friday sale because we have a one-page cheat sheet that will be available for digital download that I just updated with the new recommendations from CMQCC that you can purchase on our site for like nothing. And if you wait for Black Friday, it'll be practically free.
Right. Thanks for spending your time with us today here on this episode of Happy Hour with Bundleworth Nurses. If you like what you heard, it helps us both if you subscribe, rate, leave a rating review, and share this episode with a friend. If you want more from us, head to bundlebirthnurses.com or follow us on Instagram.
Now it's your turn to take what you learned today, apply it to your life, assess your patients, be on top of your vital signs, and follow the steps in your hemorrhage protocols based on your units and or following CMQCC and diligently assess their bleeding and respond appropriately. We'll see you next time.